Mr. Peter Baron. Mr. Peter Baron.
Hi, with Mr. Peter Bone's partner nominated to replace him after his recall by his constituents. Will this lead to that having to go up an octave? John Burko there. Also in the returns queue, Paula Venables and her CBE following that seminal ITV dramatisation. With so many other things going on, three-quarters of the News Review team met up for a bit of very good breakfast at Connigan's. Warm thanks to them on Wandsworth High Street.
Okay.
Shall we start with these mayoral candidates? And are you okay? I'm wondering how many of them you might have met. First of all, good morning from Connigan's, the News Review. Graham is away in southeast London, I think. So good morning to Leonie and Hounds. Morning, Hounds. No. Bit of silent tail lagging there.
I can make them make noises if you want.
Presumably we'd have to whack their feet, wouldn't we?
Yes, it's a bit cruel and hard.
It's the water to your satisfaction. I hope so.
I think they've drunk most of it.
And Mal Grimsley was on with Farage last night.
Yes, he did, Danny, so doing that one again.
Things can only get better now.
Well, a bit of editorial balance there and everything. Now, talking, I suppose, of balance, some interesting mayoral candidates, 13 in all, have entered the fray. We've, of course, got people from the Lib Dems and the Greens, several independents, including a businessman who's launched at the same time as a woman from the SDP, who was an ex-nurse, concerned about the state of the NHS and everything else. I was just generally wondering about the impact of these people and why on earth they do it. We were talking off mic about Lawrence Fox, weren't we, for whom it's not ended well. But is it hubris, or what is it?
I mean, first thing to notice is that Lloyd George famously said that he just didn't understand why Keir Hardie was wasting his time on a dead end like the Independent Labour Party when he could be joining the Liberals and making a difference. And UKIP was around for decades before it really made it.
Well, I misheard you.
UKIP.
I thought you said Boy George.
Lloyd George.
My name as well.
I said Boy George talking about politics from 100 years ago. That seems unlikely. Sorry.
No, it did. Yes. Yeah. Yes. UKIP were a tiny party. The Scots Nationalists were formed decades before they had any real influence. So the first thing is that parties have to start somewhere, and that it's not always the case that someone standing with an idea is forever more going to be in obscurity. I think some of them do it I think Screaming Lord Sutch is probably the most famous.
Is he still screaming somewhere?
He committed suicide many years ago. It was basically to advertise his stage act when he started it off, and then it grew into Monster Roving Loony Party. Which are wonderful policies, like putting Parliament on wheels so they could take it around the country and people could hear what was going. They've just followed from that. So some of them are in it to advertise something else. Mm. And some of them, I think,
Count Binface stood last time, and he had a very
good,
had a very very good policy, which was something to do with phone boxes, which I can't remember the full details of it. I mean, it was hilarious. But I think my issue about the ones standing for the mayor is not the ones who are so much standing to promote a party. There's quite a long list of them last time, and it looks like there's going to be lots of them this time who are all standing as, sorry to say this, Malcolm, but just as independent. So it just seems about personal self-promotion. And I'm not really sure what the point is, because unless you've got an absolutely massive budget to really promote your particular issue amongst all of Londoners, and you need a massive budget because they're all almost 9 million Londoners, I don't really see what the point of those candidacies are, and most of them only get a small handful of votes.
I think the SDP, who are still going strong, the former overnight persuasion and all that, polled 0.3 last time around.
They have had a councillor elected. I think they've only got one directly elected councillor, but they re-emerged. They're interesting. They're very pro-Brexit. As David Owen was quite pro-Brexit, having as well. I mean, clearly the current SDP, although it has the same logo and
it's inherited early everything, stages.
Yeah, but I don't think David Owen's in any sense involved with them. But that's the sort of party which, you know, you can think of the Greens, which was in, were in that position for ages, and then they started getting one or two seats. The British National Party as well, which, you know, there was this massive, I think Derek Beacon was it, the name, when someone was elected in Tower Hamlets for the BNP, and that was a massive, massive scandal. And then suddenly you had, you know, BNP would probably have won Dagenham and Redbridge if they'd put up enough candidates in 2002.
And a bit of a stoop PR, you know, tilting a little bit towards mainstream.
They were one of the largest groups on Stoke-on-Trent Council at one stage. And then, so some of them have a life cycle where they come and go. You know, BNP is basically dead completely. UKIP is re-emerging as this reform party. But they, yeah, we are not living in the two-party system in the way that we used to.
Yeah.
We tend to forget that in the Euro elections, the last Euro elections, the Conservatives polled 9%, and Labour not terribly much more. And UKIP were the biggest party, followed by the Liberal Democrats at that stage. So we have, you know, at least outside parliamentary
minority parties. Yeah.
We have, yeah, one council's run by the Greens now with a majority. UKIP won Thurrock, although they fell apart thoroughly from that. So these minor parties do get into a position, yeah, particularly in
Ireland. Labour is essentially being run by a series of independents, isn't it?
Yes, there's been.
Yeah, there's a coalition of various different people on Havering Council.
Well, there's a rate,
including Labour, actually, I think.
Yeah, very strong ratepayer group in, in Havering, as there was in Hounslow, I think, still. And Elmbridge, is Elmbridge that's been run by independents for many years, one of the Surrey districts. So you do get those with local parties as well. So it's, I think it's a bit, I do take like Leonie's point, you know, standing as a complete independent, unknown for anything terribly much. Is there, but you know, you can argue there's no point in the Liberal Democrats putting a candidate up because they're not going to win. There's no point in the Greens putting a candidate up, but they're not going to win. But that's, there's more to democracy than just what happens when you when you get elected.
Well, the Greens and Liberal Democrats have tended to use whoever they're putting up as their mayoral candidate as a means to boost their vote for the Assembly. So Sean Berry stood as the mayoral candidate and was then elected as an Assembly member, not actually at the same election. Caroline Pidgeon stood as a mayoral candidate when she was also standing for the Assembly. And this time around, the Greens mayoral candidate is also standing as number four on their list, I believe, for the Assembly. So it will be a means of boosting the Green vote in the Assembly, to the extent that when the Greens stand, they actually stand with a slogan on their ballot paper that says vote green on orange, and the orange ballot paper is the one for the top-up list, which is where the Greens and the Liberal Democrats have tended to be elected. Now, I just think it's a, you know, it's a bit self-promoting to have individuals. I think, you know, people who just seem to only be promoting themselves, and that's all it seems to be about. It doesn't really seem to be an actual campaign. Some of them, I suppose, do develop some priorities, but, you know, having a long, long list on the ballot paper of independent, 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 I don't think that speaks to what they're actually standing for. You just have a bunch of random names, don't you?
Well, there is a problem in which I know electoral law that you've got to register yourself as a political party in order, if you're to be allowed to put anything but independent. And registering as a political party is not a trivial step.
You have to register as a charity?
Specifically through the electoral law, you have to register as. So I couldn't stand as a West Hill independent, I can only stand as independent unless I register myself as a one-person political party.
The one candidate who I do think is potentially more interesting and could be quite a disruptive factor, there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not there's going to be a separate campaign by Jeremy Corbyn to stand as the mayor, but George Galloway is now declared as
the Workers' Party.
He stood before though, hasn't he, for mayor?
For the mayor of London. No, he stood in. He stood in Tower Hamlets and defeated Una King in Bethnal Green and Bow, and then he stood in Bradford West, I think it was, which Nasrallah then took back off him. So I don't know how much traction George Galloway will actually get. Somebody from the SDP actually stood in Merton and Wandsworth last time, so this is not their first rodeo, as one might say. So it's interesting
Galloway,
to see that.
Galloway's not. I mean, Corbyn would be very, very interesting. And there is this talk again of him forming a new party before the
election. There is, a Corbyn party, as we were sort of dubbing it. I don't know whether that's true. I mean, he may do, but I think he would probably be more interested in standing in Islington North and being re-elected to Parliament as a true independent rather than standing for the Mayor of London. But, you know, I don't have his ear. I haven't discussed this with him, so I'm not speaking.
Presumably the incumbent thing, if you're a one-person band, you know, the organisation of this is pretty humongous, I would think.
I guess it depends how serious you take. And I would say, I don't think it does any harm having these independents there, and I think it is a good thing about democracy that anybody has a right to stand for office. And indeed, I wish that some of those who have very loud views on all sorts of things in society and telling people they actually would stand for office and would test those views out. The people like Just Stop Oil and so on, to see how much popular support they actually have for their measures.
Well, they're not standing now, are they?
No, exactly. And I'm saying, I think in many ways it would be more courageous if they would and actually pick them. They find they get elected hugely, which would add massive credence to their campaign. On the other hand, then they find they've got very little public support, and they should bear that in mind.
The motivation, I can see the corollary of the motivation between them and these various independents whose platform we presumably discover as time moves on. I wonder if we could shift across to The Hague and your impressions of the opening South African representations and the trial to prove whether or not there is sufficient evidence of genocide in Gaza. The Israelis are, if you can put it this way, opening the batting today. So our view is probably a little bit one-sided, but there've been sort of ogres of what they might say. What's your impression of the process and how it's been mounted?
I don't know where you go on any of this. Historically, the Jews have been ethnically cleansed from all of those countries along the north coast of Africa and elsewhere. When the Arabic Empire, particularly the Ottoman Empire, was expanding, and Jews were driven out of those. There were hundreds of thousands of Jews in places where now there are none at all. And from that point of view, your starting point has to be, if we're going to accept that ethnic cleansing, then there has to be, with alongside the 55 Muslim countries, it's not unreasonable that there should be a small country which is protective of Jews. And if you could start at that point in international law. But it seems to me that, firstly, I think the United Nations view on this is very, very suspect. I think they've been very, very one-sided. You've hardly ever heard the United Nations condemnation of October the 7th. But on the other hand, obviously, the desperate fate of the people in Gaza and the Gazan population has to be taken into account as well. And I tend to think that the view that when Egypt, when Jordan, when others took out the starting point, Israel has a right to exist, then the peace process could actually travel.
As in Blinken's statement yesterday.
Actually travel in a reasonable direction. But I don't see... I've not yet had anyone say what a proportionate response to October the 7th would have looked like, those coming there. But so, in South Africa, I think the thing that really strikes me is that many of those who are so critical of Israel, and not without cause, the devastation in Gaza is horrendous, but don't take that same view when, in Syria or in Yemen or in other places where it tends to be Islam or Muslim on Muslim.
Mm. Well, interestingly, some of those were cited by, I think, one of the Irish, Irish people involved in the legal team there. The opening up the comparison.
That looks suspicious from that point of view, I think. Yeah. There are some, to be fair, who are equally confident. Muslims against anti-Semitism is one of the people I follow on Twitter.
You're going to judge them either side as part of the 17-person team of jurors. But nonetheless, how do you not politicise a situation like that? It's a very tricky line, isn't it? Points of law being addressed in painstaking detail yesterday, but they only have 3 hours, which presumably is just the thin end of the wedge.
It must be entirely political. I don't see how it can not be. And I have to sort of then think about, well, why has South Africa decided to do that? And I assume that this is addressing some sort of need on the internal South African stage for the current government, which is not in a great place at the moment electorally, and might potentially lose the next national election. There's a lot of disquiet about it's mainly to do with the government tackling the absolutely rampant corruption in South Africa, and I'm not talking just about government corruption. It's corruption absolutely everywhere. I mean, if you want to get your, you know, if your relative has died and you want to get probate sorted out, you know, anytime soon, the lawyers that will sort it out for you would expect to be paid a bribe. If you want to get the money that's released from their estate, the bank will expect to be paid. I mean, it is absolutely everywhere. It's quite unbelievable. And there's all these problems in terms of the energy supply. They have this thing which basically is rolling blackouts, but they call it their load shedding, which is fine if you don't have a life-threatening illness
that
requires you to be, you know, kidney dialysis, which obviously... So people have generators everywhere so that when the energy goes off. So there's massive... and the housing problems and the fact that so many of the slums in South Africa, which you can give various different names to...
I wonder if there's some of that resonates with the government.
There.
I
just wonder whether this is more about the South African ANC government trying to present itself in a particular way to people, but whereas I actually think what they should be doing is getting on and tackling some of these problems and issues. And I know a lot of people are feeling quite disappointed in the current president, Cyril Ramaphosa, who I think they thought was going to be a much better replacement than Jacob Zuma. And I don't think anyone's saying that Cyril himself has got his hand in the till, which Jacob Zuma clearly did have. But he just doesn't seem to have been able to tackle all the problems and issues, partly because he's been a bit hamstrung by some of the Zuma supporters within the ANC. So I just think it's a bit of a distraction. I mean, don't they say that, you know, if you've got problems at home, the best thing is to, you know, start making waves on the foreign stage. So is that why Rishi Sunak...
It is an axiom among kings.
Yes.
To use a foreign phrase.
Maybe that's why Rishi Sunak was...
Foreign war to hide a local evil.
Yes, maybe that's why Rishi Sunak was happy for attacks on the Houthis last night to be supported by the UK, because he appears to have a few problems here.
There's some almighty
it is notable that South Africa has not issued a single word against the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Not a single word.
And
now they're taking action.
Yeah, indeed.
In
and
this,
that, you know, it doesn't seem.
They've actually been to Russia and supported Putin.
Right.
So it's an economic arc that they're seeking to build, isn't it, towards Russia?
Political, and it's about Russia is clearly on the side of Hamas with these things. And it's a lot of these things are kind of proxies for the. For the big war that's going on between, ultimately, I suspect it's America and China, but with clients on both sides. So Pakistan has traditionally been Russia's client, while India has been America's, and so on.
It's often suggested by the, you know, what some people might call, and a few would, the sensible middle ground, and making a vast generalisation here, that Israel seems to be without checks and balances. And their suggestion that Netanyahu is in hock to his right-wing people to shore up his power base and to stop him getting prosecuted on those war charges.
Well, Netanyahu's is going to... The single biggest thing... the single biggest thing is, why was Israel so badly prepared for this attack? And that's one of the things that Netanyahu is going to have to be...
Did it come along at a convenient time?
There were horrendous things going on with the legal system in Israel before this. And in a sense, funnily enough, Netanyahu is also benefiting from the, you know, we've all got to pull together because of the external threats at the moment.
Yes.
But there will have to come a point where, the question is, why did it take the... I mean, there was enormous stories of bravery among the Israel Defence Force when they did arrive. But why were they not on constant alert against this? It's not as if Hamas has hidden its agenda on this. And just in the terms of the sheer practicality, if the first role of government is protection of its citizens, the Netanyahu government clearly failed miserably on that front. And I think he ultimately will need to be held to account with that. But Israel is a democracy. People can do that in Israel. There's very, very few countries in the region where people do have that possibility. Yeah. What we're seeing in Iran at the moment.
Sure. Recently, the Supreme Court, or some people associated with it, managed to just overturn the suggestion that the government would be able to override its jurisdiction. And it was said, get people off the hook, including Netanyahu itself. But I mean, I'm wondering what the end, the second act of this is. If there is the beginnings of a two-state solution, what might that look like? Leonie, do you want to come in?
Sorry?
Thinking about the two-state solution that Blinken is saying he hopes might come about.
But there is no two-state solution unless you remove 500,000 settlers from the West Bank.
Yeah.
And so the other thing that Likud and Netanyahu has been allowing, along with all of these little fragment parties who are propping him up, and the fragment parties are made up in some cases of people who are absolutely wild about settlers. There is no two-state area. There's no geographical place for a two-state solution at the moment. So unless someone actually starts to challenge the Israelis on that front, so there is actually somewhere where, the Palestinian Authority, the West Bank, and I don't even want to think about the situation in Gaza at the moment. It's going to take a huge amount of money to rebuild it. But there is no place where you can actually have two states. It's mad. And unless you actually tackle that, I think it's almost pointless talking about it now.
You can only have a two-state solution if the two sides thoroughly accept each other's right to exist.
In which they still don't.
And at the moment, it was rather like the only two vague parallels that I can think of were South Africa in the de Klerk Mandela days and Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Northern Ireland perhaps is it's vastly different, but at least it's got in common what looked like an irreconcilable difference between the loyalists saying Northern Ireland is part of the UK and the Republicans saying Northern Ireland is part of the Republic of Ireland. And it's difficult to see a way through that. And it was only, there was a lot of great work done by David Trimble from the Ulster Unionists with John Hume from the Social Democratic Labour Party on the two sides of the divide. They got nowhere, basically, because they weren't speaking to the extremists. It was only when Martin McGuinness and Ian Paisley came together as representing what might think of as the extremes of the argument that real and what seems to be lasting progress was made.
We now seem to be looking at certain structures.
There doesn't seem to be anybody in either Israel or Gaza who have the slightest intention of moving in that direction.
Yes. And I suppose it's a political expedient for either party. And also, what happens to Hamas? Because, the plain fact is that amidst the devastation, very few Hamas operatives have been knocked out. Not too many of their facilities.
I don't think anybody knows the answer to that at the moment. I think the real problem is when you're talking about a ceasefire, which is a lot of people have been calling for, it has to be a bilateral ceasefire. And whilst you might be able to call on the Israeli government to do something because they're an elected government and they might potentially listen to international voices, who are Hamas listening to? I mean, the only people they're really listening to would be Iran. And when are the Iranians going to encourage anybody to stop attacking Israel? And there are still hundreds of rockets being fired by Hamas into Israel, and so I just don't see at the moment how we get to a ceasefire.
There was a ceasefire in place on October the 6th since 2021, and Hamas made very clear, or certainly made clear subsequently, that they used that ceasefire to build up their resources for October the 7th.
Yeah.
And go back to that. Yeah, one of the problems with this is that it's very difficult to get any kind of information out of this because the Israel Defense Force clearly has a vested interest in portraying one thing. On the other side, Hamas and the United Nations, it seems, have a clear vested interest in portraying the Hamas side. And independent journalists are there very few.
They're being bumped off at a regular basis, sometimes targeted.
And that's one of the myths there, that so many of these so-called journalists actually turn out to be Hamas activists that have been targeted by Israel and been on Hamas
lists. That's an interesting line.
And
do you have a citation for that now? I mean, I'm sure you may well be.
Yes, I mean, the BBC actually recently
had
to withdraw and apologise for publishing a report without checking it. But there is, just I haven't got the citation right on me, but there's a lot of coverage at the moment.
Yeah.
And you're right, there are no genuine independent journalists in there.
Yeah.
Not least because it's such a dangerous place to be.
And again, indeed, I suppose, you know, the corollary is that there are people who become citizen journalists, someone a bit like me, I suppose, in a far more exalted role, kind of just taking footage where it can be taken.
Well, it's compounded, of course, by how expert you can now make false footage look.
Yes.
There's one or two which have been corked out where Charles has been shown there and they've actually got three hands and the photoshopping hasn't been done effectively. But you think if it wasn't for that simple mistake that had been made, you could not tell that this was a faked up photograph. And because technology has come so far in recent years on it's practically impossible even to believe a photograph.
Yeah.
The camera does lie.
Indeed. I think this is hopefully, it's interesting that the South African team did not rely, as we're told the Israelis might, on footage in order to present their argument, which presumably, had they done so, they would immediately run into those sorts of accusations of fabrication.
I mean, it is certainly important to reflect on the horrendous situation for the civilians of Gaza, and it's almost a thing where you're pushed into taking a side on this. It's very difficult to remain
just on a humanitarian.
But we need to try and do that and be equally, at least equally empathetic towards the Israeli, and not just Israelis, foreign nationals, Arabs who were targeted on October the 7th. And the genuinely innocent
on both sides. There are people who just, I mean, my old friend Justin Phillips, the next circuit judge, is over there now as a rabbinic scholar, I think, and he stood in the direct queue with Palestinians and Copts and Armenians, and people just want to get along, don't they, in the end, you know.
But I do find it difficult that South Africa is doing this performative legal action, no condemnation of Russia, and in fact support of what Putin has been doing, because despite a couple of commentators saying they think more Palestinians have died than Ukrainians have, I don't think that's possibly true. I think more Ukrainians have definitely died, and there's more people displaced.
Yep.
I mean, Mariupol alone had half a million people living there, so you know that's just one town. And the airstrikes have now been going on. It's 2 years next month. And there's been endless... I mean, if you added up the number of cruise missiles that the Russians have used in Ukraine, why has South Africa not been condemning the use of cruise missiles by Russia against the Ukrainians? Go discuss.
And the numbers... Anyway, the numbers came. You know, it was clear that far more German citizens were killed and hurt in the Second World War than British citizens. Does that mean that Britain was on the wrong side of the Second World War and the Nazis were right? It doesn't follow from that point of view. Countries are, and the leads of countries are going to create wars of this nature.
It's the fog of war, isn't it?
You need to get the balance right between an appropriate response, not overstepping international law. And the further problem, of course, is international law itself is so vague. There's not really a thing called international law. There's a few things there that the international courts say, but it's not codified in the way that national law is.
And of course, it's not binding. But you have things like Article 51, which is, I think, basically saying, again, on the South African side, which is what we know about sort of Gaza side, that technically Israel cannot attack a state that it has occupied, and that Gaza itself is not technically a state. It's a state of being, but it's basically it's a place in which people have found refuge.
But actually, the point that they've been raising at the international court is that this is a genocide.
Yes.
And the reason why I'm mentioning Russia and Ukraine is Putin has just made a speech this month where he announced that Ukraine is not an independent country. Ukrainians are not an independent people. So if anyone is... He's actually announced that he doesn't believe that they are separate. So he's either trying to kill Ukrainians or he's trying to say that they are in fact Russians. So that is completely a genocide, because he's trying to wipe out the concept of being Ukrainian.
All the dispute goes about the 11th century, doesn't it? Something like that. Way, way back.
Well, and this is not the first time that there's been genocidal acts passivity by the Russians against the Ukrainians, because there's that dreadful Holodomor that Stalin, where literally millions of Ukrainians were starved by the Russians, and they were starved to death, I think it was 1931-32, something like that. So you know, there's a long memory of Ukrainians actually not liking the Russians very much, partly because of that. So, you know, the fact that Putin is still rambling on in these very lengthy speeches saying that Ukrainians are not a separate people, this is, he's definitely trying to wipe out Ukraine and wipe out Ukrainians as a separate...
Well, as you say, South Africa not saying a dick about that.
Ramaphosa went to support him.
Sure. So think that then this, as it were, the first tranche of what might become an ICJ hearing about the Ukrainian conflict, and who might support that, and should they, by the same reasoning that we're discussing South Africa's interventions being a little bit sort of opportunist, in your view?
Well, I mean, that is... I don't know who would take that up at the ICJ. I mean, presumably, eventually, when the attack by Russia on Ukraine finishes, maybe the Ukrainians might wish to raise it themselves at the ICJ. They would be the appropriate set of people, and they certainly, they will have the evidence, I would have thought, of things like, you know, the atrocities in Mariupol, the atrocities in Bucha. And I can see that my dogs have now inserted themselves into this activity, because I think they've gone over to see Malcolm now. I'm sorry, Andy, they deserted you.
They've got excellent taste.
Yes, they have.
Different olfactory range, of course, as well. could we talk a little bit? This is Starmer and his minister, shadow minister of democracy. Interesting woman. And talking about the fact that the Lords in Labour's vision might be partly elected. Starmer was talking about abolishing it back in 2021. He shifted ground, as he's entitled to do. Do we think this is going to figure in the context of a future administration, should the legislation that would be booted go through? What's your view of this? Or is it throwing out tradition, or in the light of people like Michelle Mohn being, in quotes, disgraced, as the tabloids would have it, is the place in need of drastic reform, and should that be on sort of Brownian lines?
I mean, for me, I think, firstly, I don't like the idea of a second elected chamber. The way it works, the principle we have at the moment, we have an elected House of Commons, which produces the executive, the government. And then you have a reforming House of Lords, which is kind of the repository for the collective wisdom of the country, which will look at legislation, which will say, you know, you've the right to want to go in this direction because you're the government of the day, but this particular bit of legislation won't get you there, so you should rethink it because we think there's this and this problem as well. And it has pretty much worked like that for many years. Now, that doesn't, if you've got going to elect a House of Lords, just like you're going to elect a head of state, then they've got to be elected on the manifesto. There's got to be a reason for electing one party rather than another. That gives them a democratic legitimacy that, ironically, the House of Lords doesn't have from the very fact that it's not elected. Creates a separate, independent power base, which is bound to get in the way of governance at the end of the day.
In a good way, or possibly not?
Sometimes in a good way, but I think the good way is already delivered by the Lords, the powers the Lords do have, which is, by convention, they don't oppose anything that's in a party's manifesto, but things that are coming up, the governing party manifesto, but anything which is coming up in real time, as it were, the Lords have powers to delay legislation and ask the Commons to look at it again. Ultimately, rightly, the Commons have the powers to say, we've looked at it again and we're going to stick to our guns. The problem is that it's got into such disrepute because of the party political games that are being played, particularly. The concept that 49 days in office gives you the right to appoint peers, you would need to go back to a really rigorous appointments panel where parties could certainly nominate people, but where it was very regular, where nominations of parties were rejected on any side, because they're becoming in effect a sort of surrogate political chamber for the political parties, and at that point the whole thing falls down rather. So I don't think an elected Lords is right. There is something going. There shouldn't be any hereditary peers in there. That should be.
This
should
go. I can't see any.
There's very few now. There are very few. There's less than 100, but there are
92,
now.
But
800 peers.
Yeah, and
there's too many.
There's all sorts of areas where reform is needed. But
there's too many peers.
Yeah, why should there be any hereditary peers, though? I mean, Blair rightly made massive reforms in that part of view, but as a kind of compromise, left a few in. And they are actually the only elected peers. Well, they're elected by the other hereditary peers.
Some of them then, I know Fred Ponsonby, who lives locally, has now also been made a life peer. So he's both Lord Ponsonby.
Does he have a choice in the matter?
Yes, he's both Ponsonby of Shawbreed, which is his hereditary title, and he's also Lord Ponsonby of Roehampton, which is his life peerage, so that he can then remain as a working peer in the House of Lords. And I think he's the Shadow Minister for something in the Justice Team. I can't remember the precise title.
That's very hard.
Works very hard. Yeah. In fact, actually, I did a visit to Wandsworth Prison with him, it was eye-opening, as you can imagine. It was absolutely horrific. I mean, the rats the size of small dogs.
Yeah. Well, which he was completely unfazed, presumably, isn't he? Yeah.
Well, he goes. Yeah. He's been in there several times. Actually, he's got associations with the prison, not as a prisoner, obviously.
Yeah.
He shouldn't be allowed to be in the House of Lords. That's the two things that ban you is if you're declared to be mad or if you are become a prisoner.
Whereas those seem to be prerequisites for talking for members of the House of Commons.
Although obviously Michel Mohn may soon be being thrown out then on that basis. No, I think the problem is, I agree with Malcolm that it brings it into disrepute to have a woman who was the Prime Minister for 5 seconds and lasted less time than lettuce as the Prime Minister.
Still an influential lettuce, according to 55 Tufton Street.
What is it, 11 peerages or something like this? It was completely ridiculous. But I think the other problem is when someone like Boris Johnson, who obviously was the Prime Minister for longer, some of the people that he's nominated to the Lords are absolutely dreadful.
Mm.
And what exactly...
on his three ports,
what exactly have they done?
Yeah.
So there are now some people who are completely undeserving, who've been given peerages, and you just think, well, you know, this is just bonkers that people like this are being appointed to the House of Lords. I mean, I can understand Florence Escelloni, of course, I know well, because she was a London Assembly member for 5 years.
I knew the name.
Before she went into
that, presumably.
So we had offices next door to each other in City Hall when she was there. She's going through the recommendations from Gordon Brown and having a look at those. And I can see why having some appointed people who have specific subject knowledge of very particular areas. So I think, for example, Robert Winston, Lord Winston, has been a really interesting appointment as a life peer to the House of Lords because of his very distinctive medical knowledge.
Tremendous.
He's contributed very thoroughly, not just in his own specialism, actually, but he also speaks very interestingly on things like assisted dying as well.
Mm.
So, you know, which obviously isn't anybody's specialism medically. I think he's a very good example of someone being appointed to the House of Lords.
Mm.
But I mean, there are so many. I mean, Michel Mohn, what has she contributed other than lots of people realising that, you know, she was made a peer and has now made millions because of her association with a company that got into the VIP lane for PPE? I mean,
there was a cartoon this week of King Arthur with the Round Table saying to them, "Are any of you actually knights, or are you all just party donors?" But yeah, I mean, I always think of Derek Etherin, who was chairman of the National Coal Board, and Melvin Bragg, and Putnam, and
both of them working class backgrounds, I guess.
I can't imagine they're people who would go through the fuss of trying to get elected. And anyway, if it's going to be elected, it's presumably going to be done on a list system with the parties choosing the candidates.
Yeah.
And I think it would be a real loss if that depth of knowledge and wisdom, you know, that's where you shouldn't be putting, you know, 19-year-olds or 20-odd-year-olds who've got no experience at all of public life. It should be almost, but a definition of it should be that nobody goes in there before their 40s until they've actually had a chance to make a real difference to the world, and then make that wisdom available to the country so we get better legislation.
Well, in a way, it's a case for the valuing of later life rather more, isn't it? Which has lots of implications. for the way we live and operate in Chapel.
Yeah. A few people, younger people, I suppose, would do no harm, but generally speaking, it should be the people who've made their contribution and in their chosen field, and now make that with that collected lifetime's wisdom available for the rest of us.
So do we think that Neshalomi's and Brown's line of partial election might be the way forward?
I think there could be some merit to the idea of having some people appointed who come in because they've got specific subject matter knowledge, along with potentially some of them being elected as well. I can see that could be, it could be some benefits to that.
Mel, you might want to do by-election corner in a minute, but I wonder if we could have a quick word about independent venues. It's Independent Venues Week recently. The Sound Lounge, late of Tooting, now of Sutton, was facing closure. It's a communitarian venue in association with Sutton Council. They do all kinds of things, from hot yoga to bicycle repair to cups of tea for the homeless, and also running a range of independent music. They nearly went to the wall. Crowdfunding turned things around in 22 hours, so now they're a going concern. Do we think that there should be more provision, given the controversy about various arts council decisions lately, to look after the grassroots?
Well, there is this provision for asset of community value.
Right, as with pubs.
That's right, yeah, but it implies much more widely than that. It's the high-profile cases have been around pubs that have been closed. And we've had a number of cases in Wandsworth, I think particularly in rural areas now, where a village is in danger of losing its only hub of villageness, as it were, where people are given an opportunity by law to given a period of time whereby they can raise the money to in effect to buy it at supposedly at market rates and then to establish it. And there have been some really good, when I was doing quite a lot of work in Worcestershire, there was one particular village where the whole of the village shop and pub had been bought locally and was absolutely thriving. And because, of course, it didn't have that same, so many pubs now being just arms of the Nationals who don't really have a local focus.
Yeah, it's all something from post office, community centre, all that.
And this was all run by local people. They all knew each other, and it was very successful. And so there are those provisions there, and I think it's a very good piece of legislation. Of course, the problem in London is just the sheer level of expense that we're talking about. That land values are enormous, and there is a countervailing argument saying that people should broadly be able to do what they like with something that they own without excessive state interference. And there's that, there is that clash there between property rights.
People are in fact a corporation.
I know the people who run the Sound Lounge, Hannah White and Kieran, they're a kind of a force of nature. And actually, it shut in, they were in a meanwhile use space in Tooting, in a building that was going to be knocked down and has now been redeveloped. Then they were actually briefly in Merton, in a premises just around the corner from the Civic Centre. And then they went down to Sutton. And it's the kind of sort of very grassrootsy type of organisation that has really thrived actually in the high street there. It's a really nice place, and I think it's completely vegan, because I think they are both vegan. But they've also, because they're both musicians, they've kind of combined running a vegan cafe with all these other uses, but also music has been a big theme. And I think it was Tom Cockley, actually, when he was still an Assembly member before he became the Deputy Mayor for Housing, did a personal report, because as Assembly members we can do these personal reports, and he did one on small music venues. So there's actually quite a specific thing around small music venues being closed. So some of them may not fall into the asset of community value, but they do need protection, though. And one of the things that the mayor introduced, because there were a lot of people who were starting to take them to court, because they'd moved in next door to a music venue, and then they said, shock horror, it's noisy. So there is a principle of if it was already being noisy before you moved in, you can't really make a fuss and try and get it shut down. Which I can't remember what that principle is. It's slightly better expressed. So that has stopped people trying to
noisy on some occasions, very often.
Which
enough,
of course
isn't it?
It is, you know. There will be licensing regulations, so it can't go on all night. But anyway, so no, I mean, I, you know, more power to Hannah and Kieron's elbow. Is what I say.
I also thought of first down as you were talking there.
Oh.
And that's
you mean the independent republic?
Well, exactly. It's kind of like that, isn't it? There are these places, maybe Roehampton's another one, where people power is humongous. We all know for it around here, aren't we? I mean, West Hill also, you know. Yeah, yeah.
But some people locally wanted their own currency, and they wanted to call it. They wanted to call it the Furs.
Yeah.
I think it was when there was this whole move to get the Brixton pound set up, which
did happen well,
for a while. I don't know what happened to it now.
Yeah.
No, we're not having the Furs.
If you think about, I mean, the regeneration of Brixton and via Lambeth is pretty controversial, isn't it? And again, what happens to smaller dependents there? You know, in that, because. The corporate buyouts.
I mean, Southfields Town Centre is doing okay with its independence, but
there
is a real danger of all high streets just becoming, firstly becoming identikit with their,
but
then increasingly with voids, because of, during pandemic in particular, we've got used to online shopping, and a lot of our town centres now are really suffering from that change of...
The Mary Porter's thing, sorry to interrupt, that didn't really go anywhere, did it? I mean, a mighty force on retail. Doing over charity shops in the sense of remaking them and rejuvenating high streets. I mean, where we're sitting now, I think this has been very well achieved. You know, it's a very, very nice place to walk around.
Yeah.
People know where we're sitting now.
Yes, I think we need to say, Andy, if we're going to say that, Old York Road, which is now fully pedestrianised, and I think...
But we aren't fully camouflaged, so you'll never find us.
Well, in fact, what's very interesting is because the council implemented all these low-traffic neighbourhoods, and they basically closed Tooting.
Yeah.
They claimed there were five separate ones, but they weren't. It was just one massive low-traffic neighbourhood. Mm. And they did it without actually issuing any... warning to anybody, so people were going down a road and then finding it was close in the middle. They didn't even put signs at the end of the road. So if you look outside at all these sort of troughs containing plants, these are all the planters from every single road in Tooting.
They're all provocatively placed, really, aren't they? It's like a UDI declaration.
Well, I think it's plantage. So that cycling goes down that way in one direction and cycling comes up this side.
Yes.
Or maybe
it's
these are seats on this side of the barriers. But they all came from Tooting. They all
there
ended up
massive,
on the road.
There's a massive... Yeah.
Do coconuts migrate? Just hide them once in? Yeah, clearly.
I think it is. Yeah. It is scandal's not too strong a word for it.
Yeah.
That a number of authorities in Lambeth and Enfield, for example, who introduced low-traffic neighbourhoods and then said there's been no effect on other local roads.
Oh, that's not
and
true.
Actually,
the
what's
Lambeth
happened
one
is
really
that their equipment wasn't able to measure vehicles below a certain speed.
Yeah.
So if traffic was chock-a-block in these areas, that was coming back as no traffic because the things...
Because it wasn't moving.
Yeah, it wasn't moving. And it's, and people say, oh, it's taking me 2 hours to do a bus journey.
It used to say 10 minutes,
How can this be the case? And then finally, it was accepted that there was this, they'd made this sort of very, very basic error either in the equipment or in the interpretation of what the equipment was telling them.
Actually, people are complaining in Thursdown about the low traffic neighbourhoods that have just been installed in Lambeth, because what people are doing is to not go up Streatham High Road.
Mm.
There are various places where you can sort of turn left and come up through Thursdown.
Yeah.
And Thrail Road, particularly, has become an absolute racetrack with people trying to avoid Streatham High Road.
Do people tilt to the right a little bit or get a bit more libertarian on that particular issue? Because there's been across London, there have been so many issues with the way which was introduced that some people feel was clandestine.
There's a resident in West Hill.
It's a very good thing myself.
A resident in West Hill who goes by the Twitter handle Little Ninja. It's worth following. Little Ninja, he calls himself.
Oh, I know David Smith.
Yeah, that's right. He's a West Hill resident living on West Hill itself. And West Hill is the A3.
Yeah.
Massive there. And he's consistently made the point that those who suffer from low traffic neighbourhoods are those who can't afford to live in the leafy areas that are protected.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's those who live on the main roads like West Hill, where inevitably it's house prices are lower just by the very fact you're on the main road.
Yeah.
And how
he says they're racist, basically, actually.
Yeah.
Because he says that there's a high proportion of people from ethnic minorities live on the main roads. So tell us about the by-elections, Malcolm.
Okay, well there was four yesterday, one of them counting today, but quite interesting. Ooh. One in Pendring, which is in Essex, it's Clacton, which of course is the constituency which has the only one that's ever elected a UKIP MP in a general election. But Labour lost there to an independent, and I'm not sure I can see who the independent just missed out last time, so he's clearly established locally. But both Labour and Tory votes fell down very considerably.
Is he a Grimstonian independent, would you say?
I don't know. I was trying to find out a bit more about him, or whether he might be. Because there was a lot of UKIP, obviously, in Clacton on the council, council, around that time. It's regarded as being the most UKIP-y place in the country.
Very important. Over 90s demographic.
Yeah, with Douglas Carstairs getting elected.
I think also Boston and Lincolnshire was supposed to be quite Brexity, certainly, and I think a bit UKIP.
But that area of Essex, because you have Thurrock Council, which was actually a UKIP majority at one stage. So that's, there's undoubtedly local factors involved with that. A routine Lib Dem hold in Salford, with hardly any change in the vote in any direction. But the really interesting one's in Dorset, where the by-election there, where the Tory vote actually went up considerably.
West or east?
Down towards the south, I think.
But
and Dorset is quite solidly Tory. But the interesting thing about it is that after he was selected, it came to light that he's a paid employee of Dorset Council. And the electoral rules say, very clearly, that if you're paid for, if you're paid by a council, you can't be a councillor. Quite right, you don't want people to, otherwise you're marking your own credit. Well, how on earth the Conservatives didn't spot it, we don't know. How this guy didn't spot it. So he is now disqualified.
He may be completely unconscious while fulfilling his role.
Yeah, but they couldn't. But this only came to light after nominations closed. So he couldn't withdraw his candidacy.
Did he win then?
And he won, quite considerably, with more than half of the vote, despite the, with a considerable swing in his direction, actually, despite the fact that presumably his voters knew that he'd be disqualified automatically.
And have to get, and so what do you do with that? Do you rerun it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not. It's
so
not.
They'll have to rerun the toilet?
Yes, indeed, yeah. I mean, there are, if a candidate dies, they usually, they always postpone the whole election until the new candidate, between nominations and the election. Yeah. Sadly, that does happen occasionally. Mm. So very peculiar, where this chap who's ending up self-disqualifying.
Yeah.
The Salford one, it's on the Salford docks, the BBC sort of is in this ward. Mm. But it is the
Littlemore and Preston.
That's it, yes.
Dorset Council.
Yeah.
No independent stood, so that was minus 20. So previously there was a huge independent vote.
Yeah, and the Greens didn't stand.
And
as
also
well.
The Greens didn't stand.
The only doing Bill Flynn.
But even so, the Labour vote dropped quite considerably.
Yeah.
So the Lib Dem vote went up.
Lib Dems went up, Tories went up, Labour vote went down.
I guess the people of Dorset are saying we didn't want to elect someone else to this ward, so we'd have to elect someone who's going to be. So that's another 10,000 odd out of the coffers of Dorset Council. And presumably, I don't know if Inspector Nacker of the Yard might want to
work
with it. Because this guy must have put in, whether deliberately or not, but put in a false declaration. So you have to sign a declaration saying, I am qualified to stand for this.
Yeah, he must have signed something. Mm. But he was only going to serve as a councillor until May, because apparently the seat is up in May in any case.
Yes, it only just came in on the 6 month.
So, presumably, rule. I mean, there's a point at which some of these councils where they're going to have elections in May.
Yeah, presumably
they won't need another by-election. Fill it in May.
Yeah, the rule is if you're within 6 months of if a vacancy occurs within 6 months of a routine election, then you don't have to hold a by-election.
You used to train people in local governance. Presumably, the 101, as it were, where you start, is the legal position.
It's the rule of... people like me, I'm a very, very good agent, former director of social services at Wandsworth, who knows the area, and both my independent elections has been invaluable in keeping me on the straight and narrow. But ultimately, it's the job of the political parties more than anything else. You know, candidates coming in don't necessarily know electoral law backwards.
Mm.
And although ultimately the responsibility lies with the candidate, of course, but what the Conservatives in Dorset were doing around this, that failing to notice that this was happening, there's really some serious questions for the agents for that as well to answer.
And they're usually dim-eyed individuals. Whenever I interview a local candidate, they literally want a list of everything.
With me, Peter was we went to all the meetings that the Wandsworth Electoral Services, who are superb, hold meetings for anybody who's standing.
I mean, I have to say, this tendering one is hilarious, because we were talking about the number of independent candidates standing for the Mayor of London.
And look at them all. There's 10 of them, was it?
There's like about 140 independent candidates standing.
A lot of them are IND. And what on earth is the RFM?
Reform.
Oh, right, okay.
So Reform got almost 10%.
Yeah.
And UKIP got over 6%. Okay. So it's still a massive set of...
Well, but it's all that, the most UKIP by the Tories. In the most UKIP players, well, one of the most UKIP players in the country, and they only pick up 6%.
True,
yeah.
Demonstrates how far they've fallen.
That's incredible. There were 5 independents.
Yeah.
And presumably they're all people who were... And one of them was elected. Presumably they're all locally known. Because there's no way you could get elected like that without being known, could you? Mm. That's incredible. Anyway, by-election corner, fascinating.
Yeah. So the other one is in Brighton. I think it's a Labour defence that you'd expect to. It's in the Hove constituency, which I think
people will say we're in Hove, as Johnny Depp once said. Yeah, yeah.
But Brighton's a very interesting one. It was a minority Green administration for a while, and the Greens took a view they would not whip their group, so they just developed into 2 separate groups. They did things like they chopped down a whole lot of trees, which is not good for your Greens.
Very leafy up on the hill.
And they insisted that there was a vegetarian day each week for their workforce. Which
were they eating the trees?
At least they put them to good use, I suppose. Where it just was so, and a lot of their workforce just took lived on their bacon sandwich.
Actually, the worst thing that they did, and a friend of mine has just spent Christmas in Brighton, and so they couldn't believe how disgraceful the streets were, is they relet the street cleaning contract, and they also stopped chopping down weeds on pavements.
Mm.
And my sister lives in Hove, and I have to completely agree. I mean, you virtually had to get out a machete to walk down the pavement, because the amount of weeds, I mean, they were literally 3 feet high.
Mm.
It just looked awful. And I don't know how much cleaning was going on. It didn't seem to be a great deal. But if the weeds weren't being disturbed and could grow to 3 feet tall, you're clearly not doing a great deal of pavement cleaning. Yeah. But anyway, that was the Greens for you. And I think that's why they lost
control. Brighton, of course, is the home of Caroline Lucas, the only Green MP. So
I guess if
Essex is, or Clacton is UKIP territory, then I guess Brighton is the...
She's in Monier. There's 3 seats.
Yes,
Pavilion and Kempton.
Yeah, and Brighton has had conservative control as well, within living memory. It's very much a sort of three-party state.
It had a Conservative MP in Hove until Peter Kyle.
It's sort of South Lancashire in many ways, isn't it, to some extent?
I mean, it was 2005 to 2010. It was Labour, and I think... Mike Weatherly took the seat in 2010, but then lost it in 2015 or 17 to Peter Kyle.
Yeah.
So it has been Conservative in living memory. Not sure about Kempton. Did Kempton go Conservative as well?
Yeah, I think there have been times when all of the three seats were Conservative there. So it's an interesting town from that point of view. But
Caroline Lucas took Pavilion off Labour in 2010.
Off Labour,
I think two went Tory and one went Green, so Labour lost all 3 seats. I think that's what happened.
Anyway, so it's not, but Labour now has a majority on the council and looks, we'll see the by-election today. There's no reason to think that that will change particularly.
I think they've seen something that they consider to be of interest.
But of course, next week we will be reporting on the Tooting Broadway by-election.
Well, that's turned into being a bit of a thing, hasn't it?
What way a thing? I mean, a raging controversy.
Well, the Conservative candidate has now managed to get himself into the Evening Standard by calling for a vote strike.
Oh, yes, I saw that.
Saying to people, don't vote for Labour because the candidate works with a local MP. I see my dog has decided
what's going
to he's singing for his supper, I think, or breakfast.
Well, that's a very, very plangent view there with that particular issue.
Maybe it's time to break. And
maybe it is.
I mean, as a Tooting Broadway voter, because I just disappointed when I went round. But the Labour leaflet that came around said, you can vote for a Tory who doesn't care for Tooting and has a track record of opposing benefits for Tooting. And that put me off Labour straight away, that sort of attack. And actually, the Tory candidate actually came round and had a chat about it, because I tweeted on that. The first Tory that he flirts, I know that there has to be an imprimatur, any elected MP put on somewhere, this is produced by somebody on behalf of somebody, so you know where it's coming from. And I couldn't find it, and I looked five times until I actually, it is there, it's in the tiniest smallest writing you could possibly see, and it doesn't mention the, it mentions the name of the Tory candidate, which is the only point. So nothing on the whole leaflet mentions the name even of the candidate. I can understand why they might be nervous about mentioning the Tory party. So that was just, by definition, entirely negative.
He's trying to present himself as an independent, I think. Himself, which, I will be independent of the...
And to be fair,
of the Labour administration on the council, well, he will, but he will be part of the Conservative group on the council. So,
but how is that fair? And to be fair, there have been times when Labour candidates, you know, in the Corbyn years have done exactly the same, distance themselves from the party. That sort of depends on where national trends are going with that. But it was just quite depressing. I mean, Labour will walk it. It's the second by-election in the ward in a year. It's rock solid. The first one after Andy Gibbons passed away.
It's just movies, whether people might consider the Tories in, 4 years' time?
Well, Tooting Broadway is never going to be anything but solid Labour.
Not even with gentrification.
No, it's. I mean, I'm not quite sure why Tooting Broadway is so solidly Labour, because that's a really grumpy big housing inspectorate on which it traditionally thought of as being Labour territory. You can see that here in areas of Battersea and my ward in Roehampton.
I suppose the Sadiq factory is quite strong, isn't it? I mean, representing the huge Asian community.
He lived down there, or lives down there, so that might be a factor. But it predates Sadiq, this solidity of things. Ever since I've been around, because the class of 94, where Andy Gibbons and I were the last members, and he sadly passed away. But it was an interesting intake, because it included...
Well, it included Sadiq Khan.
And the Dean Zahawi.
And the Dean.
Whatever happened to them. But,
what did happen to them?
Yeah, it was an interesting... Well, Dean Zahawi is now a TV star, of course, having appeared in the Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. So it was interesting how that works, but it's always been solid Labour ever since I've been around. And... there's areas which are solid Labour, which of course, like Thursday being an obvious example, which is safest Labour ward, but was certainly Conservative for most, certainly my first few years on the council.
We had a Conservative councillor in Thursday until 2010.
Is that Ian Hart at that stage, or Claire?
No, it was
Claire Clay.
And so then she got moved to Wandsworth Common, which is, I think, where she lived at the time.
Difference in average income there.
Very close for the demographic change, so much that Leonie now is the biggest vote of any Labour councillor on the council. So.
No, well, apart from you.
Of any Labour councillor, I said.
Of any councillor.
Yes, yes.
I have more votes and a larger majority than any other councillor apart from you. We are the two councillors who have the largest majority and also the largest personal vote. There you go. On that note...
Thank you so much. Thank you for showing up, as I say, all last year and hopefully continuing this year. Thanks very much, everybody. See you next time.
Cheers.
Cheers, Andy.